Hello, another episode of Room With A Review podcast. Still don't have a great intro catchphrase, but that's okay. I'll stick with what I've been saying. I'm David, creator of this, and this week's episode is Megamind. If you've not seen Megamind, it came out in 2010, animated movie distributed by DreamWorks, but a Paramount movie. I thought it was earlier than that. I thought it came out like 2008-ish, but obviously not. And I found it really interesting as a parallel to Despicable Me. They both came out the same year. You got Will Ferrell and Steve Carell as the voice of both. And they're good friends. You've got Tina Fey in Megamind and Brad Pitt. So, like, really big names in that. And I think, especially, don't know about now since The Office, but 2010, Will Ferrell is definitely the bigger name. Brad Pitt, obviously huge. And Tina Fey was, like, it was peak 30 Rock. So she was huge. She had Mean Girls that had come out a few years before that. She was doing a couple of movies that were coming out. Yeah, so that big name cast. Whereas Despicable Me was a little bit... Steve Carell was on the rise. And obviously been in Anchorman with Will Ferrell. But other than Evan Almighty in The Office, hadn't really established himself. He'd done Little Miss Sunshine at that point, but not many feature movies that were catapulting him. And he did go on to do, I think it was around the same time, a movie with Tina Fey. So it was really, really interesting that they came out at the same time. But in Megamind, I found it, as I said, a good parallel to Despicable Me. We've got this... I can't remember why, but it must have been a reason at the time. I'll have to dig into it. But why are we getting these movies about villains turning good? Because that's essentially what this is, and that's what Despicable Me is founded upon. And then 2 and 3 obviously launched, it had its own sequels. Megamind never got that. But it was just this weird... That's why it felt earlier to me, because when I was watching it, it felt like it had laid the groundwork for Despicable Me to work off and go, oh, okay, we get it. And maybe they came out different times of the year, but when I looked at it, it didn't really indicate there was a big difference. There would have been development, like they wouldn't have turned out Despicable Me in the space of 10 months. So they had to have been in development at the same time. But yeah, it was very strange. And as I said, they were both distributed by DreamWorks, so I don't think they initially have had overlap, and I don't think they would have been released at the same time because they would have been competing with each other. But it was very, very strange that what was happening in Megamind was, as I said, very much the groundwork for Despicable Me. We had this villain who realizes that he needs, and it was almost like Lego Batman 2, where in Lego Batman, our Batman character, he defeats all villains and Joker lets himself get arrested, and then Batman realizes that there's no need for Batman anymore. And that's what happens in Megamind, but the other way, we've got the Megamind character, the villain, who defeats all the hero, and then essentially there's nothing left for him to do. So it's interesting that it laid the groundwork for some of these later movies that came out, including, as I say, Despicable Me and then Lego Batman. And the movie just evolved from there, that we've got this character who is a villain and trying to portray himself, and it was very, very funny, by the way. But then throughout the movie he thinks, okay, well, I need to create another hero, and goes down that path, and it just evolved from there. And it's really about, can he stay bad, and is there a good part of him being bad, sort of thing? Can he actually ever be good? And it did a good job of kind of showing the back and forth between that and changing around who was the villain, I think. And that's why, I mean, it did a good job of forecasting for Despicable Me the path it could take, although this one went a little bit further in having a bit of a reversal from being bad to good to back to bad again briefly, and how it all fit together. So I thought that was pretty interesting. But as I just said, it was very, very funny. Lots of really good jokes. And some of them were set up and just kind of running jokes too, which I thought was really good. Despicable Me had lots of humour throughout in terms of organically created, and it relied a lot though on the three little girls kind of carrying some of the jokes with their cuteness and inverting some of the stereotypes you might expect from all of the characters in that. Whereas Megamind just didn't bother. It's like, no, we're not going to invert stereotypes. It just had straight out humor comedy going for it. And it really built on the characterization that happened. And I think we had this opening monologue, not a montage either, but this opening sequence where the hero, as it were, and Megamind as a villain were set up for us and just contrasted. And all the way through, there was this characterization by the contrast from the other one, or from the villain. And then as we got another villain later on, that was further contrast. So the characterization was really, really strong in this. Whereas Despicable Me, the only character that really shows development is Gru. None of the other characters drastically change, I wouldn't say. Whereas Megamind, all of the characters underwent some kind of change and growth, which was interesting. That's what I mean. It's very interesting between the two movies, how they've developed character and things like that. In terms of plot, though, it was a little bit messy. It was a bit... it started developing one idea, and then it added another, and then it added another, and it kept having to kind of create a new complication, because the central complication that it was overarching, but it started the first kind of 15-20 minutes was good versus evil, and then the next complication was, oh, there's no good, so evil's won, and he kind of got bored and needed something to define himself by. But then there was, he kind of went down that path, and yeah, there was, I don't know, it was just a bit odd that central complication didn't really have enough going for it, because once he created another villain, they're like, okay, good, that's done, we can move on to something else. They didn't engage enough with a hero versus villain properly, as in Megamind. He made a change, and I said briefly, he went back a little bit, but it just didn't, that complication was kind of never resolved. It just went, instead, we're just going to create a new plot. And so the final third was this entirely kind of new part to the film. So, yeah, I don't think plot was a strength, but in terms of characterization, as I said, that was definitely very good and quite funny. So, getting to the part where I say this is how I would use it in a classroom teaching it. I've said before that we do a hero's topic. We also do a villain's topic. I think it would fit the villains really well, especially that first. You watch 15-20 minutes of it and you'd cover everything you need to, because in that 15-20 minutes, and even half an hour, which is a good chunk for a lesson, you could get through that half hour and then pull out lots and bits and pieces for it. And it would give you a good 20 minute, give you a good couple of activities you could do from it about, as I say, especially characterization, but also the good versus evil dynamic. And I think that's a key idea. And it was very concrete too. So it's a good starting point to talk about villains and what makes a villain. And I mean, Despicable Me does it too. There's a good 15-20 minutes at the start of Despicable Me, and that's what I'm saying, these two movies, you put them together and you get a very classic sense of a villain. It doesn't help for later on if you want to go down a more nuanced and sophisticated path, but for a majority of students, it would paint a very clear picture of what a villain is. And it also goes into the rationale behind it a little bit for Megamind as to why he's a villain. We get, again, part of the characterization about his development, why he becomes the rival of the hero and why he chooses to do bad things. And I think that's good, because that's always been one of my problems with villains, is why do they want to take over the world? What are they going to do when they achieve that? What's the purpose? Okay, they get rich, fine. I don't know. There's too many villains. I think there's maybe a 90s thing more than anything, where they just, I'm evil for the sake of being evil. But Megamind, we have a very clear justification why he does what he does. So in terms of that, I think that's probably the strength of it. And as I said, the first half hour, after that, I wouldn't bother teaching as a full text, but once he achieves victory, you'd probably want to stop there. as I say, the characterization of the villain, very, very well done. So, Megamind, it's very easy to watch if you're stuck at home with kids, which a lot of people are at the moment. Definitely one you could put on, but got a pretty cool soundtrack, got to admit. Although it lent into the rock, hard rock especially, a little bit too much. It didn't have a range, so the soundtrack was good, but it was fitting, but they didn't really, I feel like they got to put more thought into some of that. But overall, quite good. And as I said, did the first 20 minutes or so, and you've got quite a good amount you can do with it if you're teaching characterization, but villains as well. And even if you wanted to do a contrast with Despicable Me, I think that would work really well. And just pulling out all the threads of how they came to be, you could definitely look further into it than I did. But as I said, two movies from very much the same era, and even same groups of people and same production studio, how it all came together. But that is it for Despicable Me, but not for that. I fooled myself. Not Despicable Me, that's not the movie I was talking about. Megamind, that's it for Megamind for this episode. I will be back in a moment with Ad of the Week. Ad of the Week this week is a couple of different ads, but they're all ads I use to teach certain different features. So they're all tourism ads, which obviously we're not going to have any of those anytime soon, but I can't wait to see also, once the pandemic is over, what the tourism industry does to respond and how they encourage people to travel, because they're going to be one of the hardest hit industries. And I was listening to someone talk about what Las Vegas is going through as a very tourism-driven city. I mean, they were meant to have the NFL draft a couple of weeks ago, and they lost a ton of revenue. Austin, South by Southwest, again, was a similar sort of situation. I know these are US examples, but same for other places around the world. The tourism is going to affect it, and it'll be interesting to see the money if people have to go spending it on big holidays, if people have leave that they're due, people that booked trips that are going to try to book them in, and whether that'll make it harder to book trips and the tourism industry will recover quickly, or will it take a lot longer because people go, I haven't got the money to spend, I've now got to save up for a long time again to go and do a big trip. So it'll be interesting to see how all that plays out. But these ads I want to talk about. The first one is from the 90s, I want to say, it when it first appeared. And I use it often. I used to use it as a related text for belonging, which I think tourism ads, travel ads were very good at covering anyway. So when we had the area of study belonging, it was a good text to do, and there was lots of those that did that. But yeah, it's the Where Else But Queensland ad. And it's an ad I remember watching many, many times. It kept coming on, you know, at all times of the day. And so it really did a good job of showing the diversity that Queensland has without emphasizing too much the movie world side of it, because they had their own ads, obviously. So they showed things like Great Barrier Reef and lots of beaches, but also some of the deserts, the tropics up around towards Northern Territory area, the Cape York, Torres Strait kind of area. Things around Brisbane were in it, and the Gold Coast, and they obviously did include the theme parks that were up there. But it was a good ad because it showed geographic kind of ideas as well as activities, and very much a eventful place. And so in terms of, as I say, belonging, it was really good because it showed the social, emotional, physical / geographic sense of all of that. And I think that's where that text is really, really good at showing some of those things. But you then get a lot more creative tourism ads, and print ads especially. They're very easy to Google. There are some very impressive ones for different parts of the world that I use, and I just pick and choose at random. There's 10 at least that I know I've used, and I'm only going to talk about a couple of them. And then it's interesting when you get other Australian tourism ads. There was one that went through the Super Bowl a couple of years ago with a lot of the Australian actors in Hollywood that were like Hugh Jackman and Chris Hemsworth and the like, who were kind of launching a, was it a Mad Max-esque ad? Off the top of my head, I can't remember what it was now, but it, again, same sort of thing. It was just use star power, brand name, actors to really push certain things. But I'm not going to talk about that ad in depth, because again, I'm not, I haven't watched it enough to really be able to talk about it. But then we had the, what was the model name, the one that dated Michael Clark? Lara Bingle. The Where the Bloody Hell Are You ad. And we got mocked pretty hard for that. People found it a bit meh. So you've also got some interesting ads. And again, it provides an interesting contrast, those different approaches to advertising parts of Australia. You had the Melbourne Run Rabbit Run ad, which was weird. But again, you say it and everyone knows what you're talking about. So it's yeah, there's definitely some good and bad ads to use to show effective advertising and poor advertising. I think if you wanted to look at some of the visual techniques used as well, they're quite good. But in terms of visual techniques, these print ads as well, there is quite a few that are quite good. So there's ones for different parts of California. There's one about red gums, and it's, and a lot of it's scenic natural landscapes. And it's just a little bit of text, maybe three words, and just pure images of the same thing and a little bit of a tagline. Those are quite good. I really like them. You could look up, as I say, USA tourism ads or California tourism ads. You should be able to find them pretty easily. I don't think they have a specific name because they're a print text, but they're really good in terms of salience, contrast, not so much vectors, symbol. And again, we talk about ads in terms of demanding an action. I think demanding that action is quite strong, and they really indicate, and they appeal to a wide range of audiences too, because of the different ads they've got. So one is more, as it's the redwood tree, so it'd be the big state forest they've got there. But they've got another one that's a wall with, I should have looked this one up because this is one I forget a little bit, I don't use it as often, but it's got a, pretty sure it's got someone playing an instrument, and it again has something slightly different. So you can see again these ads that are just very good at symbols. There's a lot of tourism ads for Africa that just feature animals. So there's ones with giraffes, there's one with an elephant that I know I've done, and all it does is just has a person standing close to these animals essentially in the savannah, and again just uses symbols, perspective, social distance, gaze, that kind of stuff, it foreground and background. These print ads are very simple, and I strongly recommend using tourism ads to teach print texts if it fits what you're doing, obviously. But I think they're very clear in conveying the experience they want the tourists to have through these ads, and they're more or less effective. I don't, in terms of getting the message across. Now, what these ads lack is the immediacy of go and book now. I think that was what maybe the TV ads are a little bit better at, because you're usually sitting there a bit passive. A print ad, you kind of might look at it and flick past it, and it has to kind of plant the seed rather than you actually then there and then book a holiday. Whereas I think maybe a TV ad is more likely to make that happen. Maybe that's just me. Maybe that's just what has more of an effect on me. But these, yeah, these print ads are a bit, they don't have the direct impact you'd want them to, but again, they're cheaper, so I guess you're making less of a risk of paying more money to not have it pay off. Don't know. I guess I don't make those monetary economic decisions for advertising agencies. But I do think in terms of using techniques effectively, they're good. In terms of getting the desired action, not so much. But as I say, I strongly recommend look up different tourism ads. There are plenty from around the world, print ads especially, that will cover exactly what you want. There was the mock ad. I believe it was a mock ad, surely not. It was a real one. But the See You in the NT ad, if you haven't seen it, just look it up. You'll see exactly what I mean. Again, visually effective in terms of the action desired, maybe not. So there's some ads for you, but as I said, some of those Australian tourism ones are very weird, whereas print ads, much safer and effective in terms of communicating a message, just maybe not the action you want. But I'll leave it there for ads and give you my recommendation for this week in a moment. My recommendation this week is two musical acts. One is Janelle Monáe, who you may know from Hidden Figures as an actress and a couple of other movies, things she's been in, but she's also a musician. I want to just recommend her album that came out 2 years ago, I think, called Dirty Computer. Just really, really good. Very various styles used. You got some Prince-inspired pop songs, more guitar-driven. There's one, especially Americans, that's very Princey sounding. But then you've got others that are more slower ballady type one. You've also got some that are mixture of different hip-hop genres that vary into rap and slow down, more of a East Coast type, I guess. And the album is brilliant. It's got so many allusions to different things throughout it. That song I mentioned already, Americans, just, I used it a few weeks ago just to showcase allusion. It was just brilliant. And to another one called Django Jane, again, very clear allusion being made there. But various songs that she's got, just filled with great wordplay, not just even allusions, but metaphors, symbols, contrast, like so many language techniques used in them that, I don't know, it's that cliche thing of, hey, I'm an English teacher, I'm going to teach rap. But that's why I went with Americans rather than one of the other songs that is a bit more rap heavy. And again, some of her other songs are just pop songs, which are fine. But as I said, she's got various styles, and there's some that are, you can't use them with students because of the nature of them, but definitely Americans is one you can. And there are a few others on there you should definitely look at, but just in terms of musical styles, I think there's something for everyone. That if you don't like two or three songs early on the album, you like some of the middle ones. If you don't like those, you'll like maybe some of the later ones or different parts. I like most of the album. There's a couple of songs I'm not super happy with, but as a whole, it's got, I think, 10 to 12 songs, and I like 8 of those. So, you know, that's really good. The song Pink, if you're going to listen to that, I recommend watching the music video for it, because you may not pick up exactly what all the parts of the song, but when you watch the video clip, the song really is enhanced. But again, that's not one you would do with students, I would probably say. Depends on your situation and what you feel comfortable with, but it's not one I would do. It may be one that students wish to use at some point, and I would have no problem with that, depending on what they're using it for. So there's one recommendation. The other one, though, is Master Boot Record. They're I think it's called a chip tune, is the genre. I'm just bringing up the texts I sent to the music teacher I work with that I was talking to about with this group. So, yeah, it's called chip tune, and it uses a lot of that 8-bit style kind of tone of music, but it's also got this kind of symphonic classical component to them, as well as electric industrial, but also kind of like a heavier, not metal necessarily, but it's in a mixture of all of those things. And I was listening to her for hours and hours and then the other day. So this is an Italian artist called Master Boot Record, or Master Boot Record. I'm not sure exactly which version of the word it is on my phone's there, but definitely look it up. Master Boot Record and Janelle Monáe. I'll just read these couple of messages I sent to this teacher. It's what I said was kind of a weird mix of Dream Theater, Pendulum, Nine Inch Nails, Rammstein, Ghost, Crossfaith, Metallica, Dope, Classical. Can't even begin to describe them. I know also add in their Ministry. So they're just these rant, like, and that, if you know any of those bands, you'll know they're kind of varying styles. It was just pretty bizarre. They're so unique that maybe is why I was drawn to them. But all instrumental. Check out a couple of their songs. You'll find some are much better than others, but overall they just kind of blend together. So it's really good music just to have on and be doing stuff. Very up-tempo, energetic. But again, it would be good soundtrack music, I feel. So yeah, that would be my second recommendation for you, is Master Boot Record along with Janelle Monáe. Look at either of those acts, covering a broad range of musical styles between them, and yet at the same time not that far apart either. So go check them out. Oh yeah, and War and Peace is coming up, don't forget. And of course, War and Peace finishing us off today. Nothing new there. I've pretty much caught up to where I was meant to be. So if you were listening along for the last couple of weeks, I'd fallen a bit behind where I wanted to be. I said last week I was at halfway. I should have probably said I was almost at halfway. I'm a couple pages short of it now. I've pretty much caught up where I should have been, although I'm not exactly sure if I'm back on track or still a few chapters behind. I lost track of exactly where I should have been at this point. So when I hit that halfway point, I'll kind of reset and keep making sure I am back on track. So it should be in the next week I hit, not definitely in the next week, I'll hit halfway. I'll make myself hit it. And then that would just mean I can, pace out the second half for the last 7 months of the year, or 6.5 months, 7.5 months. So I should be done at this rate in November, I reckon. But it is really a matter of me not having weeks like I did the other week, and then not quite catching up as quickly as I should have when I had the chance. So in terms of War and Peace, we're getting another engagement, basically. Nikolai Rostov and Sonia are about to be engaged, and Nikolai's also going to go back and join his regiment, and we're starting to see some cracks in the relationship between Andrei Bolkonsky and Natasha after they had a very quick courtship, and he proposed with an arrangement of waiting a year. But not really, again, major developments. There's often the last few chapters, I think what's been happening, you get a chapter to set up everything, and then you get a complication in the next one, and then you all get and it doesn't get resolved immediately, so it's building long term. So you'll get a chapter that's setting things up, a chapter to create the complication, then often with some kind of social conflict. That's what the majority of them mean lately, and then it just kind of keeps going on from there. We kind of get the next little bit and next complicated relationship. So that's where it's been at the moment. Again, I'm waiting for it to pick back up. I really like the first third of it, but the last portion, whatever, second third, I guess, or well, not second third, but yeah, second third and third, not second third. Yeah, first third, and then the third sixths that I'm up to now. Yeah, there's some good fractions for you. Has been a little bit slower. So yeah, it's gone much more into the relationships between the characters, which again, when I said earlier, it was not hard. It was a little bit difficult to just track exactly who each person was, their relationship, because you had cousins that were treated like sisters or brothers. And there are people that come in for a few chapters, disappear, and then come back, and you go, remember this person? No, not really. That was 300 pages ago, and we've met 20 people since then, and 20 things have happened. So that's one little thing I'm noticing, but I do think that it'll be interesting to see where the second half of this book goes, given it feels like it hasn't taken off still. I thought it was, and then the Napoleonic Wars pretty much over. I'll be interested to see what happens in the second half and what is kind of happening there. But I'll leave it at that. Thanks for joining me for another week. I will put out another episode sometime in the next week. I'll try to keep them as regularly as much as possible to these times, but sometimes I might be a few days late like I was last week, and hopefully I don't have those same tech issues too. But thank you, everyone, and I hope you enjoyed this week.